Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of The Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, where our mission is to make visionary community improvement the norm in the social change arena rather than the exception. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about this sector's potential for creating visionary social change. I'm so pleased to welcome Martin Bruckner as my guest on Making Change. Martin's current title is lecturer, an educator and researcher in the Sustainability Program and the Institute for Social Sustainability at Murdoch University in Western Australia. But that doesn't begin to describe why I'm excited to have him join us today. Martin's life has taken him from his native Germany, where he studied and worked in the world of business, to the U.S., and eventually to Australia, where he has lived for the past 17 years. That path has also led him from an initial focus on business and industry to a focus on how sustainability issues affect business and industry, and finally to a focus on all the various factors that fit together to create healthy places to live, from policy and governance to economics and public participation to sociology and natural science. Given the breadth of his research and practical experience, and particularly his studies of communities who are fighting for the right to be healthy and whole, it is my pleasure to have Martin Bruckner share his observations with us today, here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is Martin Bruckner. Welcome, Martin.
Good morning.
Well, good morning, good evening for us. Talking to you from Perth, Australia, Western Australia. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you tell our listeners, before we get started, just a little bit about your background? You have had quite a diverse background over the years, and if you could just tell us a little bit about the path that has brought you to the work that you're doing right now.
Well, my work's in the area of sustainability and sustainable development. It's been a bit of a roundabout journey for me. I started off with business management and economics at the time, and after studying that for 7 or 8 years, I found that wasn't quite for me, left too many questions unanswered. And I moved to environmental science and sort of worked at the interface between environmental change and business activity, and sort of looked at the roles and responsibility of business in the sustainability context and got more and more involved in the sustainability field and more interested in it. And I've then shifted pretty much entirely into social sciences and natural sciences, and I've basically been an educator in sustainability ever since.
Quite a path. Now, did you start this path in Australia?
No, it started off in Germany, where I began my undergraduate studies, continued in the States, where I spent a year in Georgia. And I then came to Australia in 95 and finished my studies there and have then started working in academia ever since.
Wonderful path, a truly global path.
That's true.
Well, I start off these interviews asking the same question, and they're always an interesting answer. So I will ask you, in the path that you have taken and the work that you have seen and the observations, especially as a researcher that you've been looking at, when you see change happening, what do you see underpinning that change? What are some of the factors that are going on when you're seeing things happen?
Well, I can basically answer this only in light of the research that I have done, which is sort of looking at our communities pitted against big industry. And for me, it was generally, well, what all my research findings sort of have in common is that triggers for change are generally a rising sense of disquiet with the status quo and people becoming personally affected by changes that are occurring. We hear a lot about the various wrongs in the world, and many of these wrongs occur thousands of kilometers away from us. Mm-hmm. We may have an opinion on this, but it may not trigger action, it may not trigger change. Whereas when change occurs or when people are impacted more directly, so when things happen close to home, I think it's a bit of a wake-up call. And especially on the community level, I've found that communities were galvanized very quickly on certain social or environmental issues and were prompted into action. And to me, that has always been sort of a standout trigger for change.
So when it's really affecting you personally.
Yes, well, that's right, because otherwise there are just too many degrees of separation, I guess, between the various things that are happening. Even though people may be indirectly affected, if the physical distance is too large, if there's too much of a time gap, too many lags, people feel strongly about it, but that's also where it ends. Whereas if their lives, if their day-to-day lives are affected, I think to me this is the primary driver for change. To give you an example, we hear a lot about the impacts of mining on communities. We hear about environmental impacts as a result of industrial activity, but this is generally happening elsewhere. Whereas it sort of has a bit of a NIMBY aspect to it, people not wanting things go wrong in their own backyard. Mm-hmm. But I find as soon as that's the case, this is where the greatest momentum comes from for change at the community level.
Can you give an example of a mining activity where you have found that, or some activity where you have found that people have suddenly become alive over something?
In Western Australia, we've got this stellar rise of the mining industry, which basically over the last 20 years has taken on proportions that are historically quite unprecedented here in Western Australia, where mining moved from obscurity to become the powerhouse, not just of the state, for the entire nation. Now, whilst Western Australia is geographically very large and very sparsely populated, the mushrooming of the mining industry has basically meant that mining operations have come into very close contact with local communities, whilst beforehand they were working in relative isolation, which basically meant that all of a sudden communities were confronted with large multinationals next door. And a study I've been closely involved with for the last 4 years is basically a tale about a community that has been living for many years next to an alumina refinery, which at the time when production levels were relatively low, the relationship between the mining company and the community was relatively harmonious. As soon as production levels increased and technology changes were being introduced, the emission profile of the industry changed dramatically, and with it, the community impacts. And the community was basically of the view that, you know, this is nothing that can't be fixed. The company would simply have to clean up its act, and that the government would certainly look after them, protect them. After a few years of campaigning, they realized that there was very little traction.
Wow.
Neither on the side of government nor industry. So the community pretty much found itself alone and quite disillusioned with the entire democratic process and policymaking in the state for environmental protection, the protection of community interests. And they basically embarked on a 10-year plus campaign and running. So This community is still agitating wildly on the case of having their rights protected to basically live unharmed next to an industrial facility. So it's not anti-corporate, it's not anti-development, especially since many community members actually work for the company.
Right.
But there is the right to be actually left alone once they clock off after work. So they don't want to be affected by emissions. They don't want to be affected by noise, and basically want to be left alone by the company in their private life. So it was that infringement of that negative right of being left alone and being left unharmed that they're basically defending and have been campaigning for now for the last 15 years. And these are people who have previously not been politically active. These are people who in the past have not had strong views on industry. And matter of fact, this is a community that lives in an area that faced relative industrial decline for 20, 30 years, where industries like timber and agriculture have been waning. And so the arrival of mining was actually a welcome change.
Right.
So this, to me, was a very good example as to where a community that has previously not campaigned on any other grounds or felt the need to press for change politically or to agitate against the company has all of a sudden been galvanized over this issue and become quite a formidable force and have become quite expert in being uncomfortable in the political and commercial realm.
Have they seen any successes?
Well, in many ways, yes, I would say so, in the sense that they've been able to stall further expansion plans by industry. As a result of their agitation, environmental laws have changed. Additional conditions have been placed on the refinery with regards to emission monitoring and pollution prevention.
Wow.
In that sense, various changes were introduced subsequent to the community basically applying pressure to industry and government. Have the issues disappeared? No. This is why the case is still ongoing, and as a matter of fact, the community is suing both the government and the company for neglect and failure to act to protect community health and interests.
Wow.
Well, in that sense, success is relative. In many ways, they've had many wins in the sense that they were able to trigger change in corporate practice and also to change the way in which the regulator deals with industry. But since we started off from a small base and that regulation, that area in Western Australia has not been particularly strong, there's still a long way to go.
It sounds like they have had incredibly good small wins. but that they really have their eye on a different prize than these small wins, that all of these little battles, that's not where their sights are set.
Well, that is true. I mean, what the community ultimately wants is either the industry to operate cleanly. Given the processes that are employed, this may never be possible. Mm-hmm. In that sense, what the community is opting for and is ultimately asking for a relocation package that essentially the entire community is being uprooted and relocated elsewhere out of harm's way.
Wow.
But it's increasingly difficult because the entire southwest of Western Australia is now undergoing industrialization. And in that sense, it is becoming increasingly more difficult to find pockets without industrial operators nearby. Because of the mineral deposits that are being found in the southwest, it becomes increasingly lucrative to start mining operations in that area. So we're running a bit out of space. So the community also finds it difficult to find an area where they could actually go. And that's particularly true for farming operations, because this is prime land where this community sits, of which we don't have that much in right. Western Australia. Soils are pretty poor. So for farmers, it is particularly difficult to find alternatives.
It's interesting that when, depending on how one is looking at the question, what you said earlier was that this was not a community that was anti-corporate. What they wanted was healthy lives.
That's right.
It's very, very interesting that the thing that's moving them forward, it seems, is just a drive for things to be good, not the solution to various minor problems. It's not this little thing and that little thing. It is that overall sense that we want to live healthy lives.
Well, that's right. The community agenda has grown over the years and, in my view, matured somewhat, because it became no longer just a single issue campaign with regards to emission. It was basically about community sustainability and looking at the broader question of how we can basically have jobs, have incomes, have industry, but at the same time conduct business in a way that it doesn't erode the basis for a good life. So they've been incredibly successful in forging networks, well, across the state and internationally, with other NGOs and community groups, basically mounting a campaign for, yeah, as you said, a better life, of finding means and ways where community can protect what they have, can protect their sense of place, their sense of belonging. And what's another strong feature there is that sense of community cohesion, which has been suffering greatly over the last 15 years, because the community that I've once studied as such no longer exists. There's been a great deal of fracturing as a result of the conflict. So their case is also one of basically protecting communities and protecting the cohesion within communities, as they see that as being under threat with the arrival of industry.
Talk a little bit about that sense of community cohesion. Has the split happened since the community started fighting the mine?
Yes, well, that is true. It is, has widely been described as one of those textbook communities where, for generations, families have been living and working locally. In terms of its location, it's a very idyllic setting. It's nestled right between the ocean and the Darling Scarp, which is sort of a fault line 40 k's inland from the west coast. It's a beautiful setting. It was basically a place where it was very, very difficult to move to, simply because nobody was leaving. There was no property on the market because nobody ever wanted to leave. So right. It was a kind of place where people have been living for generations, for a very long time, and they felt they had something very special there, where everybody knew everyone, where, you know, kids grew up happily, right. and everybody lived there happily ever after. It was that kind
and of... And not a lot changed, I'm going to guess, from generation to generation and year to year.
Somewhat true. Certainly, as I was describing earlier, the economics of the region have changed, because agriculture, with the deregulation of the milk industry and so forth, basically meant that various small farmers left the area. Also, timber production, that which used to be very large and a staple within the region, where they had their own locomotive works and so forth to feed the forestry industry, all of that has vanished over the last 40 years. Wow. So the town has been undergoing change. So if nothing would have changed, mining wouldn't have arrived, the area would have been structurally quite weak.
Sure.
But from a community point of view, that is certainly true, that it was a place where everybody knew everyone, and for generations people have been living there, and in that sense it's been a great sense of stability and robustness to the community fabric. What changed in 97 is when the first problems arose and health problems started to emerge, that the community was not affected evenly throughout, whereas it was quite possible that within a given street, people in number 5 and in number 9 were suffering health consequences, whereas people in nearby properties didn't. So in that sense, there was a degree of reluctance to readily agree that it was industry emissions that were to blame.
It is really interesting as you're talking. I'm sort of picturing your opening statement when I asked what creates change. And we talked about the fact that when people are affected locally, when their lives are affected locally versus something happening thousands of miles, thousands of kilometers away. What you're now talking about is not just a local community uprising, but person by person and family by family. It continues to be when people are personally affected, they're much more likely to be looking at avenues for changing rather than just looking broadly at the common good. It really is coming back down to now we're talking about neighbor by neighbor.
And this is also how deeply the divisions ran within the communities. That's a very fair synopsis. It wasn't just nearby, it was very close to home. It was in people's home. And because we're talking emissions, people did feel trapped inside their homes because they felt they couldn't go outside. But again, that was the experience of some, but not of everybody within the community. And as a result, there were strong views being held on both sides of the camp, whether industry is to blame or not.
I'm curious in your research if you find in other communities as well and other issues that that same pattern of being personally affected, whether it's the community immediately affected or personally affected, if that same pattern shows itself.
Well, I think it does, especially in areas where industry is a new arrival, in that it does introduce change to a community and it does represent a break to past patterns of life. We have various development proposals currently on the table in Western Australia where communities look at the specter of having very large industrial facilities next door. For some, this is a great opportunity in terms of employment and income generation. For others, this is a direct threat to their livelihoods because they see a certain incompatibility with their own business activities and that of their corporate neighbours, especially those operating in tourism feel greatly threatened because all of a sudden the appeal of the region may suffer as a result of industrial activity. For others, it's a fear of emissions. For Indigenous communities, is the way in which cultural and heritage aspects are being affected as a result of that. Yeah, I think we see that play out many times over. So the case that I've been involved in is in no way unique. I think we see that repeated left, right and center here in Western Australia, but also across the country, in that, we are simply moving into the backyards of people and that predictably having a large impact on the way the communities but can function and how they, whether real or perceived, are being affected by those changes.
It really raises the question of, and I wish I had the answer, but I'm fascinated by the stories that you're telling because it really raises the question of how we translate that. If what it takes is a personal involvement, personally being affected, how we translate that to create a bigger sense of responsibility for folks or a bigger sense of I need to take action, maybe that impetus to take action when it's not immediately next door. We see this happening in issues regarding climate change, where the folks making the decisions are so tremendously removed from either a seashore or someplace where something is immediately happening. They're sort of looking from afar. It really raises that whole question of how do we translate that? How do we create that impetus, that feeling that, wow, I really have something at stake?
To me, it is very much a question of it not being really part of the public or political discourse. I think despite large or big ticket changes and problems that we are confronted with, and you mentioned climate change, that's sort of the most widely debated one at present. Even though we've had the various awareness campaigns, Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth and various other programs and reports that have been sort of in the public domain now for the last 15 years in an attempt to raise awareness and to drive change, what this has done is it created, just that, an awareness. The cognition is there that climate change is an issue and that climate change is real, even though still some camps successfully raised out about the accuracy of the claims made by the IPCC. But nonetheless, I think the majority of people, certainly in Australia now, accept that climate change is a reality. But at the same time, I think by framing the issue as an economic issue primarily, because we're basically looking at economic means of addressing and mitigating climate change, we're looking at various tools such as carbon taxation, emissions trading, and various other tools, which are all economic in nature. we are reducing a hellishly ecologically and socially complex phenomenon into something that is purely economical. And I think that in many ways leaves then the action on climate change in the hands of industry and in the hands of politicians and removes it from the base, that being the public. Mm. So in a sense, we're doing our bit for climate change because we're now paying a tax on carbon.
Right.
We're basically leaving it at that. When you talk about the impetus for change, I think we take it away by reducing A, the complexity of the issue, by putting it in the hands of so-called experts, them being economists or politicians at the time. And in that sense, it creates a certain inertia. There's no further action required other than with the voluntary reductions and flicking the switch, turning off the lights, buying more energy-efficient appliances. But that's the extent of it. So it doesn't really drill down to the question to perhaps looking at more fundamental changes in the way we structure our economy and the way we conduct our lives.
It is fascinating. I wish you could see my face because I have that wow look on my face, that it really does take something that is complex and social in nature, which is exactly what happened in that mining community. It was not just an economic decision. It was happening to people's lives. It was how they lived with each other, how they worked, how they spent their day. It had to do with their health. It had the complexity of all of those issues. And they were dealing with every single piece of that issue every single day. Where when you relegate, as you said, these complex social and integrated issues into purely economics, that it takes away that piece that you talked about throughout, that this really is about people's lives being affected, and that's really the start of what creates change.
I believe so, yes.
I can't tell you, Martin, how I appreciate you taking the time with us. This has been absolutely fascinating, and I wish I had 2 hours more to talk about everything that you have learned along the way. Hopefully we can check back with you in a year or two and find out how this community is doing and what is going on. But thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Speaking with Martin, the stories he shares don't seem like they're a world away. We can feel the anguish of a community that is split between economic woes and environmental and health concerns. To that community, this is not an academic exercise. This is their lives. We see that same story played out whenever significant change occurs. The U.S. civil rights movement wasn't won by concerned citizens from far away. It was a campaign fought by people whose everyday lives were being affected in ways they could no longer tolerate. I was also struck by Martin's observations about the continuum from awareness to action, and that for people to take action, issues have to move beyond conversations about economics and policy to become conversations about how each and every one of our lives is being directly affected. Perhaps the most striking thing about the observations Martin shared is that what would be considered a deficit or weakness, a family struck by severe illness, or a person denied his or her basic rights, that weakness is actually one of the most effective strengths when it comes to taking action to create the world we want. Which leads to questions for your own work. In your own work to create a healthy community, who is working harder, your organization or the people themselves? If the answer is you, what small steps might you add to ignite more of the potential in the people themselves to act on their own behalf? As you share stories and frame conversations with people who may feel somewhat removed from the immediate situation, how are you connecting the dots between a family who may seem remote and how that family's circumstances directly impact the person you're talking with? And when it comes to awareness campaigns, what percentage of the activities in your plan are focused on raising awareness and getting people to understand the issue versus the percentage of your plan that's focused on getting people to take action? And if your plan is mostly about raising awareness, what steps can you begin to take to shift that percentage so that more of your efforts result in people taking action to create change? As you begin exploring these big questions, I hope you'll share your observations at the Chronicle's website, philanthropy.com, and at Creating the Future's Facebook page at facebook.com/creatingthefuture. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me through our website at creatingthefuture.org or on Twitter at @HildeGottlieb. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you the second Thursday of next month here on Making Change.